Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Yes, once again, the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon as I bring on another Christian and atheist for a debate. We're going to be having a clash of the titans, really, today on Unbelievable, and I'll be introducing them both in just a moment's time. Don't forget, though, that if you want to find out more about the programme, if you want to listen to past shows, get resources and all that kind of thing, and indeed find out more about my guests today, do go to the Unbelievable webpage. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Later on in the programme, we'll be hearing some of your feedback and, of course, more details about the Spring Harvest event that I'm involved in April, when I'll be leading some seminars on apologetics. And today is one of our shows that are themed, tied into the Spring Harvest themes that are going to be happening during April. So let me introduce today's show, who I've got in and what we're talking about.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today's topic is why I am not an atheist. David Robertson joins me on the programme. He's a familiar face, or voice at least, to many listeners. He's the minister of St Peter's Free Church in Dundee, director of the Solas Centre for Public Christianity. He's recently contributed a chapter to a book called Why I'm Not an Atheist, hence the title of our discussion today. In it, a variety of people explain the reason for their faith. You can find out more about David and his ministry at solas-cpc.org. My other guest on the programme today is Matt Dillahunty, someone I've wanted to have on the show a very long time. He's the host of an online TV show and podcast, The Atheist Experience, based out in Austin, Texas. He regularly debates Christians there and, of course, on public stages too. He's a leading voice in the online sceptical community. Find out more about him and the various things he does at atheist-community.org. As I mentioned, this is the first of three programmes tying into this April's Spring Harvest theme, which is, funnily enough, unbelievable. It's based, though, around the Apostles' Creed, which, of course, begins, I believe in God the Father. Well, today, David will explain why he does believe in God and finds atheism incoherent. And Matt's going to be responding. And then next week, there's two bites of the cherry for these guys this time round. Matt's going to get the chance to explain why he's not a Christian, and David will respond. So it's great to have you both with me, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on the program today.
It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, let's say hello to you, Matt, as someone who hasn't been on the program before. But as I mentioned, your name has come up numerous times over the last several years. I think we must share a number of listeners on our respective podcasts. You've been hosting The Atheist Experience for several years, but take us back yourself, because I think you did grow up in a religious environment. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And in fact, my parents and most of my relatives, you know, they remain Christians. I was raised in primarily a Southern Baptist environment. I walked down the aisle at church, I think, during a revival when I was about five and accepted Jesus into my heart, and then went through my teen years very, very active, literally in church 5 or 6 days a week. Most of my friends were there. And, you know, to be honest, I'm not trying to claim that I was super Christian. There was, you know, obviously social aspects to it as well. But I believed and I was serious. And like many of my friends, I thought that God wanted me to be a minister. I ended up in the Navy instead and then in the tech industry. And at some point, I found myself without a job and with plenty of time and money. And I said, okay, God, if you want me to actually be a minister, then I'll do it. And I spent a couple years in prayer and study and talking with people and came out the other side very different.
Hmm. And, different enough that you eventually decided that there was no God.
Well, it's not so much that atheism is the decision that there is no God. It's I'm not convinced that there is a God. People often portray agnosticism as some middle ground, and I think that that's actually false. I mean, there is no middle ground between believing and not believing.
Okay, well, we're going to get into the issues today. Just briefly, though, would you like to spell out what the atheist experience is, which many people will know you for?
Absolutely. It's a public access television program, so it's on cable TV here out of Austin, Texas, but we also stream it live over the internet. And we take live calls. It airs Sunday currently from 4:30 to 5:30 Central. And it's a chance for us originally, it was just to interact with the atheist community and reach out to theists of all stripes so that people wouldn't maintain the same perceptions or in some cases maintain the same misconceptions about who atheists are. It's a good chance to have discussions and debate. It's not always pleasant. people take, you know, it's very difficult to attack someone's beliefs, no matter how sincerely you're trying to attack the belief and not the person, and have them not take it personally, because this is foundational to who they are. And I am a fallible human being like all of us, and have probably done some below the belt topics or conversations at time. Sure. But by and large, it's something that, you know, the show's been on for more than 15 years. I've been hosting it for 8 or so. And we take live calls, pretty much anybody who calls, you know, who actually get through. And so there's a handful of people that we had to ban because they were, you know, just, you know, trolling or doing prank calls. But it's a great venue to actually have some conversations. And we've had some conversations that it took up an entire show. I mean, Ray Comfort and Matt Slick and other apologists have come on. So it's not just random callers.
Okay. Well, we're going to be talking on today's show. You're going to be talking to an apologist, a Christian speaker. He's a minister. Great to have you with us, though, Matt. Thank you for being with us on the program today. So my other guest today on the program is David Robertson. As I mentioned, minister of St. Peter's Free Church in Dundee, a regular contributor to this program as well. David, thank you for joining me today.
I'm delighted to be here. It's nice to be back down in London and nice to connect with Matt as well.
Yes, you've obviously seen Matt in action online, I assume.
Yes, I have. I've seen the good stuff and the bad stuff, so I have every sympathy with him.
I mean, I know that many people sort of see you as always up for a bit of a debate, David. So I don't know whether you at all see yourself as sort of
the anti-Matt.
Matt's opposite number.
Yes, there's the Christ and the Antichrist and the Matt and the anti-Matt. Yeah, maybe.
Maybe you could start your own show, the Christian Experience or something. Who knows? But what we are going to be just mentioning at this point is you've contributed a chapter to a new book. Do you want to tell us about this? Why I'm Not an Atheist?
Sure. Do you want me as well? I'll maybe introduce that and then maybe line things out for Matt. And Matt,
sure.
Then Matt, you can choose whatever particular angle you want to go on with any of them, because there's obviously a massive amount of stuff. The Why I'm Not an Atheist book comes, of course, out of Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian, which was a fascinating collection of essays, which is probably one of the 10, 20 most influential books in the Western world of the 20th century. And I reread it, and a friend of mine, Alec MacDonald, who's a minister in Edinburgh, he had written a little leaflet about why he wasn't an atheist. And so a group of us got together. We asked different people from different backgrounds, can you write us basically an essay on why you're not an atheist? And we liked them so much that we put it into a book, and it's been doing really well, actually.
And it's quite a variety of people, isn't it? People from various different professions, walks of life.
Journalists, psychiatrists, ministers, obviously clergy people, scientists. Really is quite fascinating. I mean, I love the opening line of Donald Bruce. He says, I'm a scientist, I think like a scientist, that's why I'm not an atheist.
Right.
So that gets things going.
Well, all right. What do you say in your chapter then? Because in a sense, I think you wouldn't say you've ever been an atheist at any point in the past.
No, I tried. I mean, it's interesting because I've actually, a couple of weeks ago, I was in a Southern Baptist church, and it was an interesting experience for me. So Matt and I are coming from very different cultures. And not least, I mean, Matt's basically a failed Christian, and I'm a failed atheist, because I grew up in a secular, largely atheistic culture, which is what Britain is today, where in your education system, your media system, your science and so on, it's presupposed that the default position will be atheism or agnosticism. I grew up in a Christian home, but pretty very, very early rejected that, largely because of the culture and school and questions I had. And I desperately wanted to be an atheist, because for me, being an atheist was just so cool. And, you know, you die, that's it. You don't have to worry about anything. And it just, you know, I tried hard, but I just couldn't do it. I tried really, really hard. I became a communist when I was 14. You know, I supported the Vietnamese against the Americans. Sorry, Matt. But I, you know, I just couldn't do it. I failed. I mean, to me, atheism in this country is a little bit like a rite of passage for teenagers. You get over it. You go through it, you know, and then you kind of wake up and come to see that, nah, it's just not going to work.
Well, I know Matt's going to be eager to respond already, but in terms of the content of the chapter itself, what are you kind of saying then as far as your reasons for why I'm not an atheist?
I give a little background to Bertrand Russell's thing, because actually, if you read Richard Dawkins, it's just Bertrand Russell. In fact, any of the new atheists, there's nothing new. It's all Russell. And so what I did was I went through Russell's thing and I just responded to each one. So, I mean, I would say the main reasons would be, for me, I state that I'm not an atheist because art requires an artist. In other words, creation requires a creator. I'm not an atheist because of Auschwitz. That was what I studied at university, history, and particularly the Weimar Germany. And the question of evil doesn't make sense in an atheist worldview. I'm not an atheist because I'm a skeptic. I think to be an atheist requires a great deal of faith, and I just don't have that amount of faith. I'm not an atheist because of the church. There's a lot of things in the church that would make me want to be an atheist, but my experiences in the church and the community and so on of the church have really drawn me away from atheism. I'm not an atheist because of the Holy Spirit. I would argue from experience now, that's not a proof to anybody else, but it's a testimony to, I think, how God has worked in my own life. And then probably the last one is, I'm not an atheist because of Jesus Christ. And I probably don't want to go into that one because, as you said already, Justin, we're going to do that in the other show.
Yeah, we will. We'll do that next time.
So that would be the, you know, Matt can feel free to pick up on any of those. I'm happy to discuss any of them.
Matt, okay, well, we've heard David sort of laying out his case in a very brief nutshell kind of way. And the floor's yours now, really. Which area do you think you'd like to respond to? Where would you like to begin?
Oh, if only I could begin with all of them.
Indeed.
Because some of this is actually a bit confusing for me. When, you know, obviously we're coming from two slightly different cultures, with, you know, the UK being much more atheistic than the United States, for sure. But, you know, so when I hear things like, oh, this is a teenage phase that people get over, I hear that directed in the United States towards some younger atheists, and it just always seems so absolutely condescending. And it's kind of frustrating, because there are atheists who are atheists for bad reasons. And it seems to me that when David goes through and talks about how he tried to be an atheist, most of what he cites as his reasons for not being atheists are what I'd call bad reasons or confused reasons. I guess I can start with the beginning, where he started with art requires an artist and creation requires a creationist. This particular argument is circular. If you get, of course, art requires an artist, but how did you come to the conclusion that it was actually art? You don't simply see something and intuit and recognize that it necessarily had a designer. Design isn't recognized by complexity. It is design is recognized by contrast against something that is naturally occurring. And so when people point at nature and call it creation in order to claim that it must then need a creator, that to me is a kind of a dishonest relabeling, because first you need to demonstrate that it is actually a creation. And in order to do that, you'd need to contrast it with nature, which is naturally occurring.
Yeah, do you want to respond to that? That's your first point, as it were, that's being brought into contention.
You know, I mean, I really don't want to confuse Matt, but I mean, there are lots of people, as he knows, in his own culture who... I hear a lot of atheists in the US, and they talk about when they were Christians, about 12, 13 years old, and they talk about it being a phase that they went through. And I would say, yeah, they probably did go through a very juvenile, and they have a very weak understanding of what Christianity is. In terms of the actual question about art and so on, yeah, I think, I would recognize art. I think people who don't recognize art or design, I think you've got to willfully turn away from that. My argument would be about the creation. If it's not creation, what is it?
Well, you don't get to just claim that it is. And if you say...
Well, I do, and I am claiming that it is. So what is it? If it's not creation, what is it?
Your actual question there, if it's not creation, what is it, is a veiled argument from ignorance fallacy. Basically, you're saying if somebody can't tell you what it is other than creation, creation stands as the most reasonable position. And that's simply fallacious.
Yeah, that would be fallacious. Yeah. But are you telling me that you can't tell me what it is?
Well, it depends on what you're actually talking about, because we have lots of different labels for it. We have nature, the universe, reality. It depends on the scope at which you're talking. But if you're going to claim that it's creation, that's something you need to demonstrate is actually true.
Yeah, and I'm quite happy to demonstrate it because it's very simple.
Okay.
When we talk about creation, and by the way, I mean, I found it interesting that maybe it was a slip of the tongue rather than a creation requiring a creator. You said creation requires a creationist, because I think that means something slightly different.
And I think it's probably accurate.
Yeah. Yes, I know, but that to me indicates the prejudice and that you're coming from. Because what I would want to simply say is this. You know, I grew up on a farm, and as I said, I did want to be an atheist because in one sense it did make sense. But as I grew up in the Highlands of Scotland, and as I looked out over the Dornoch Firth and saw the dolphins, and I worked with cows, and I saw, you know, everything that was, let's call it nature, that was there. It was clear to me it was material. It was also self-evident to me that it wasn't accidental. Now, or at least to me, it required a great deal of faith to believe it was accidental. But what I did was, instead of going, right, the world was created 6,000 years ago, which I didn't believe, or instead of saying, God obviously created this, I asked, where did stuff come from? The key question of all is, why is there anything at all? And we really are left with only three options that to me make any sense whatsoever. And I read people like Paul Davis and so on, who divides these three into nine, but they're all basically the three options. One is what most scientists, in fact, what Bertrand Russell believed. He believed it absolutely, that matter was eternal and that everyone believed that and accepted it, that the universe didn't have a beginning. And the Big Bang kind of blew that one apart. So Russell, in that sense, is very, very dated. But you can believe that matter is eternal. You can believe that matter was created and came into being. Or you can believe that matter self-generated out of nothing. Now, the third option is farcical in logical terms. So it's one of those two. You either, as John Lennox says, you either believe that matter, your mind, came from intelligent mind, or it came from mindless matter. And I don't see any other way around that.
Yeah, see, and this is part of the problem. You know, everything that you've talked about here is you looked at it and you came to this, you can't see any other conclusion, and then you list the options. And the option that you failed to include, one which addresses something you raised earlier, is that we don't know what the answer is. And when you say that you're a Christian because you're a skeptic is someone who doesn't believe something until there's sufficient evidence for it. And to say that you simply haven't found a better explanation, and so you're going to go with this one, is fallacious and unskeptical, because the God concept has no explanatory power. We explain things in terms of other things that we understand. We begin with the simple things we understand to explain the more complex things. When you posit God as the explanation for the universe, it is literally logically identical to saying magic. You're taking something you don't understand, something you don't have evidence for, that a panacea, explain it all Band-Aid, and saying, we don't know the answer to this, so I'm going to stick this proposed God explanation in here, which has no explanatory power. It tells us nothing at all. It is a way of halting inquiry and investigation and understanding about the subject.
Oh, not at all, Matt. What you're doing there, I mean, it's that if you forgive me saying this, that's entertaining waffle, because you're trying to bring in God of the gaps as this is what you're doing. You're saying we don't know, and, you know, it's kind of, well, it's just the way it is. That's just how we see it. I'm highly skeptical, but I'm skeptical about many things, not least I'm skeptical about your ability and my ability to be able to determine, and, you know, anything at all, actually. But I look at this and I say, let's start with a fact. What's the fact? The fact is that there is matter. Now, that matter must come from somewhere. And I look at options. How do I determine it? It's called common sense. It's like saying, how do I know that you're not a green banana? I mean, we can just keep going round and round and round in circles. You're obviously going to make certain limits. I'm going to work within logic, and I'm going to work within empirical science, and I'm going to work with observation. So here I am in a studio. There's a table. It's matter. There's Justin Brearley. He's matter. He's not a ghost. I know that there is matter. So the next question I ask is, where does that come from? You're saying to even ask that question is fallacious, and I think that argument is a cop-out.
Okay. Let's allow Matt to respond. Yeah. Go ahead.
Asking that question is a wonderful question to ask. What I'm saying is that when you answer it with something that you can't demonstrate, with something that you have no justification for, with something that doesn't have explanatory power, that's where you've committed the error. When this idea that you ask, how do you know I'm not a green banana? Well, it's not just intuition. You seem to kind of overlook how we actually learn about the universe and how good we are at intuiting things based on our past experience. You know I'm a green banana because there's mountains of evidence that build up this idea that people aren't green bananas. You have no other universes to compare it to. You can't compare the universe to anything. No. And so you cannot say, oh, this is what a designed universe looks like, and this is what an undesigned universe looks like. Or this particular type of matter, the only matter that we can investigate, the only type that we know about, necessarily comes from being, well, perhaps in some other reality that's not necessarily the case. There's no comparison to make to reach the conclusion you've reached.
But the fallacious argument there logically, I mean, I'm just talking, I'm speaking from a logical position. The fallacious argument there logically is that if you have nothing to compare it with, then it cannot exist. And I think, or you cannot work out what it is. I think the logic here is very straightforward, and you're trying to avoid the question. We do know that if there is matter, that matter must come from somewhere. It either, you've got the three options, you can't suggest another option, and all you're doing is saying to me is, well, I don't want to be drawn into one of these three options, I'm just going to say there could be other ones. And in that sense, there's no point ever having any conversation. Because
correct answer is we don't know.
Yes, of course the correct answer is we don't know, but you can't opt out of things like that. That's like a fundamentalist redneck Christian in Texas going, well, I don't know about Jesus, but he lives in my heart. I mean, and you ask them questions and you mock them and all the rest of it. I'm sorry, but when the boot is on the other foot, you cannot come and say, there's matter. Now, asking the question, where does matter come from? You turn around and say, well, there's another option that we don't know. I'm saying there are three logical options. We may not know which one.
And
that's true enough.
You know, how have you limited it to three? What is your justification for saying that those are necessarily the only three and then concluding that yours is the correct one?
No. What I've done is I'm saying these are three and they are logical. You're just turning around and saying, well, I want to avoid the consequences of that, so I'm just going to say that there could be a fourth, a fifth, or a sixth.
I mean, can I just jump in here, gents, just for a moment? I mean, one thing that strikes me in this whole issue is that obviously very often the fact people who do believe there is design to the universe are going on the basis of their common experience of what they take as being designed, obviously. And obviously those advances in science, the Big Bang, fine-tuning and all the rest of it, appear to bespeak a universe where we were intended almost as an outcome. Now, is this the kind of issues that you're talking about, David, that where we're seeing, as it were, evidence for design, or is it even more fundamental than that?
Yeah, well, I think it's even more fundamental because I think Matt's presupposition is there is no God, there cannot be a God. I'm sorry, but Matt, that's how it comes across. Because let me give you an example. You're like the person to me who walks on the beach. And John Lennox often will use this kind of illustration. And he comes across, spelt in seashells on the beach, I love you. Now, everything about his experience tells him that somebody who's actually done that there, that it wasn't just the waves who did it and so on. And that there's some aspect of design, there's some intention of communication and so on. Now, he can look at different ways. How could that have been? Could it have been your million monkeys with your million typewriters or your million seashells or whatever doing it? Could it have been an individual who came and did it? Could it be someone who's trying to tell him something? Was it there from a previous lover's meeting or whatever? What is not valid logically is someone looking at that and go, oh, that's pretty amazing, but I can't think about that because there could be other options that I haven't thought of. I think it's perfectly, in fact, you're going to get nowhere in thinking about anything in life at all or any kind of rational discussion. If any time options are put up, you go, yeah, but there could be ones that we don't know. So all of these are automatically excluded.
Come on, now this is just flatly dishonest now. First of all, you accuse me of beginning with a presupposition that there is no God, which is flatly false. As a matter of fact, you know, we already know I was previously a believer. I didn't get there because I just presupposed there was no God. But the example that David's given of walking along a beach and finding "I love you" spelled out there, of course you are going to recognize that as design. The question is, why and how do you recognize it as design? And it's not because it's complex. It's not because you merely intuit or use common sense. You use the intuition and common sense that is built on the experience. And the experience comes from contrast. All of the available evidence points to "I love you" being spelled out in seashells as consistent with design that we recognize. We see people do this. We know we do this. We have no evidence to support the idea that this is going to happen without this. However, that said, there are plenty of examples of people seeing messages in things that clearly weren't designed. Now, when you look at this, and you conclude there's a designer, you're making a decision about what's most rational, and you are necessarily doing that by taking your experience and contrasting what is naturally occurring with what you know to be intelligently designed. And while you can do that with what appears to be letters spelled out on the beach, you cannot do that with the universe because you have nothing to compare it to. And when you use these simple analogies to kind of dig into the minds of people, of course it looks like that, you know, well, that just makes so much sense. You're being disingenuous because the two things "I love you" spelled on the beach are not and the universe are not remotely comparable. It's not like anybody walking along who speaks English and sees those words spelled out on the beach is going to recognize this. That's not the case for what you appear to see as design in the universe.
We're going to take a very quick break. My guest today on the show, already having a fantastic debate today, Matt Dillahunty and David Roberts. And Matt Dillahunty hosts the Atheist Experience out in Austin, Texas. And David Robertson, my Christian guest here in the studio with me, is the director of the SOLAS Center for Public Christianity. Today we're talking about why I'm not an atheist. And David is defending his chapter in his book of why he's not an atheist. Matt Dillahunty is asking the questions. And so we're going to continue this discussion in a moment's time here on Unbelievable. With me, Justin Brierley, it's the show that aims to get you thinking. We'll be back in a moment's time.
The church is facing a crisis of confidence. Should Christians still believe in the Bible? Can we have confidence in God? And does he have confidence in us? At Spring Harvest this Easter, discover why you can answer yes, yes, and yes. Spring Harvest will challenge your thinking, feed your mind and spirit, and top Bible scholars will give substance to your confidence in God and his word. Spaces are still available, and prices start from just £117 per person. Book now at springharvest.org.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this afternoon's show. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the show that gets you talking, gets Christians and atheists talking as well. Don't forget you can find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And we were getting into such a good discussion already in that last section that I didn't even get a chance to tell you how you can respond to anything that either of my guests say on today's program. So if you do want to email in, give me your thoughts on today's discussion topics, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you'd like to follow us on Facebook, that's facebook.com/unbelievablejb, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account. And of course, all the links to that and to my guests today available from the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And today's discussion is on why I'm not an atheist. It's David Robertson of the SOLAS Center for Public Christianity defending a chapter he's written in a book of the same name, in which he explains why he believes in God but finds atheism incoherent. Well, this is the first of three programs tying into April's Spring Harvest theme. It's a major conference that happens here in the UK every year in the run-up to Easter. Well, this year, there's a certain sort of apologetics type of theme to it. I'm going to be helping to lead some of the seminars there. And it's based around the Apostles' Creed, which of course begins, "I believe in God the Father, the Almighty, creator of heaven and earth." Well, we've been asking whether there is evidence in the universe for a creator in the first section of today's program. Matt Dillahunty of the Atheist Experience is our sceptical guest on the program today, and we're going to allow David and Matt to continue this conversation now as we ask beyond just this issue of the creator God and so on, and what else we might want to respond to. David, do you want to just sort of pick up where we were in that last section?
Just very quickly. I mean, first of all, I am delighted that Matt admits the possibility of God, and I'm also delighted that, intuition, common sense, reason, and so on are to be used, because that's exactly what I would use to believe in God. And I'm a little confused about his not being able to determine whether something is real or true unless you've got something to compare it to. For two reasons. I don't think we've got anything to compare the Big Bang to. There's lots of things I suspect we have got nothing to compare to. And also, just maybe we can move it on by my just simply saying, I think God is incomparable. And I think to reduce God to our own comparisons or experiences is obviously, well, for me, I actually think that's a little bit arrogant and possibly delusional. I'm not saying particularly for Matt, but just for all of us as human beings. So, yeah, I would go with God as being incomparable, and that's another reason for me actually to believe in him.
Matt, I do want us to move on from sort of the debate we've been having thus far about whether God, there's any evidence for God as creator and so on, to talking about other aspects that David started out there talking about. Do you want to pick up any of his other reasons for why he's not an atheist?
I would, and I'll apologize for this, and you can feel free to chop it for time, but I did not admit the possibility of God. I don't know how I could possibly determine whether or not God's possible. And I also didn't say that you can't tell whether or not anything is real or true if you have nothing to compare it to. I was talking within a very specific scope about determining the cause of something. But the other points that David had raised, one of them was he said that he's a Christian, or he's not an atheist, sorry to get the phrasing wrong. He's not an atheist because of Auschwitz. And this baffles me because I don't know what Auschwitz has to do with atheism at all. So feel free to expound on that.
Hmm. Yeah, sure. Well, because if you are an atheist in the sense of, let's say, Richard Dawkins, a naturalist, materialist, you will do as Dawkins says, there's no such thing as good and evil in the universe. The universe has all the properties that we'd expect if there was no such thing as good and evil. I was fascinated by, and I studied the Holocaust, Nazi Germany, why the most advanced culturally scientific a cultural nation in the world could end up doing the Holocaust. And I've been to Auschwitz. I don't think I would go again. I just found it just absolutely horrendous. And the problem there for me, initially, I started off saying, well, there can't be a God because of he wouldn't allow all this bad stuff to happen. But then I got really stuck because I looked and thought, well, how do I know it's bad? How can I say it's bad if we're just chemicals who happen to have evolved over a long period of time, and morality is just a social construct and so on. If there is, as Dawkins says, no good and evil, then how could I say that Auschwitz is evil? That's just just my brainwashing, the way I've culturally been brought up. And I realized, no, it's not. And so the whole question of evil does not make sense without, in my view, a biblical worldview. Dawkins himself says that to have an absolute morality is virtually impossible without religion. So I actually think the existence of evil is actually, and my awareness of evil is actually an indication of God. I mean, it makes it impossible for me to actually be an atheist. If I'm an atheist, then I just have to accept evil as just something natural.
Actually, no, you don't. I mean, you're what you're talking about. That originally, when you said Auschwitz, I thought you were going to go down the route that it was caused by, you know, Hitler being an atheist or something like that, which isn't the case. So I'm glad we haven't gone down that rabbit hole. Really, what you're talking about is the moral argument, the problem from evil, and you seem to be just taking Dawkins' view, which I'm not saddled with, and neither is anybody else. I don't necessarily agree, and I'm not even sure that you're representing Dawkins, but he can come on and talk about that himself. The idea that good and evil aren't things, that they're not extant things, is pretty common. But I'm not a moral relativist. I'm not portraying a view, as you have adopted or have claimed that atheism adopts, that morality is just opinions or social constructs and things like that. That's not my view. And moreover, the view that I espouse, which is I've talked about in my lecture on secular morality and the fact that it's the only moral system, is consistent with humanism, which would absolutely make something like the Holocaust not impossible because people can still do things, but it is absolutely in conflict with the idea of a Holocaust, this idea that humans have value and that we determine morality based on real physical facts. We are physical beings in a physical universe. When we're talking about morality, we're talking about well-being, and killing people, killing 6 million people, slaughtering 6 million people is obviously, flatly in conflict with well-being, both of those individuals and of the society as a whole. I mean, nothing could be more clear. We don't need to make an appeal to, as a matter of fact, appealing to a God to say, this is why this is wrong, causes even more problems, because God could decide tomorrow that slaughtering 6 million people is okay.
Okay. Let's just let David respond. So as far as Matt's concerned, it's obvious. For the well-being of people, you don't go slaughtering them. What's the problem, David? Why isn't that obvious? Why would you need to invoke God to understand that?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't need to invoke God, but I think I'm always wary of fundamentalists saying something is obvious. I think we have to look and say, well, why is it obvious? Obvious to whom? So, for example, if you had been brought up in Weimar Germany and you believed that the Jews were rats and that they were harming society, if you'd been brought up in a theory of social Darwinianism which taught that the weak should be eradicated, then why not? If you live in a society which says, look, an unwanted child is no good, so let's kill it in the womb, let's kill 20 million or whatever, then you will do that. So when I'm always wary when atheists and secular humanists say it's obvious, because what they mean is their position is the obvious one. And to me, it's not obvious.
It's not obvious to you that, I mean, I don't mean to use obvious as just the reason, and that was just the shortcut, but it's not obvious to you that killing people is against their well-being? I mean, how else could you define well-being if it doesn't preclude being slaughtered?
Well, that's true. That's interesting. So you would say that it was against the well-being of the child in the womb to kill it?
Well, yes.
So you'd be against abortion then?
No.
So you think that that killing the child in the womb is against the well-being of the child, but you're for that?
Did I say I was for it?
You said you weren't against it. And basically with abortion, it's like it's like your thing with agnosticism. You say you either believe or you don't believe. You either think abortion is correct or you think it's wrong.
I'm actually pro-choice.
So being pro-choice, you've just told me that you think killing the child in the womb is against the well-being of the child, but nonetheless, yes. you are pro being able to do that.
Yes.
So there are some circumstances in which killing someone is actually okay. That's what you're saying.
Yes. Yes. Lots of them.
So your whole argument against me was, is it not obvious to you that killing someone is against their well-being is completely superfluous? Because you've just admitted it is okay.
You're going to avoid this obvious example. I'm only talking about this situation.
Yes, well, I am talking about, put yourself, instead of putting yourself in your own mindset, put yourself in the mindset of someone who grew up in Nazi Germany, or in Weimar Germany, and then it became Nazi Germany, and they have been taught that the Jews are rats, that the Jews were the result of Germany losing the First World War, that the Jews are the result of them being unemployed, that the Jews are a cancer on society, that mankind is evolving, and all the rest of it. You made an interesting thing about Hitler, and I'm not going to say that Hitler was an atheist. He certainly wasn't a Christian. But
he was in public and in private, and was supported by the Catholic Church, and they ran around with Goldman Unz on their belt buckles.
Oh, well, that is hilarious. You know, that's like all the American congressmen who say that they believe in God, or in God we trust. It's like that's like saying that every American is a Christian because you have "In God We Trust" on your dollars or whatever. Look, you're not debating a third year school kid. I'm sorry, but you can't get away with that. Goldman Unz on it. You do know that that was the motto of the whole German army.
I do understand that, but you also know that Hitler espoused his Christianity both publicly and privately, and used his Christianity as justification for his views.
Yes, and would you like to give me an example of that? Because I can explain that. I mean, I'm sorry, but this is my period, and if you want to go ahead with this, go ahead. Give me an example.
A quote that he had about secular schools can't be tolerated because such schools have no religious instruction, and a general moral instruction without a religious foundation is built on air.
Yes.
Consequently, which sounds exactly like what you're saying. As a matter of fact, if I hadn't attributed this to Hitler, I don't know that it would be different from your position.
Yeah, but except this, Matt, as you should know, as any historian should know, and you're talking about comparing things, if you make a statement without a context, it just becomes a pretext. Do you know where Hitler said that, by the way? And do you know when he said it? And do you know to whom he said it?
I don't know to whom. I know it was during negotiations which led to the Nazi-Vatican Concord.
He said it in 1933 before he had his final election where he was going to be elected chancellor. He was speaking to the Catholic Teachers Union before he had his Concordat. And of course, as a politician, he's going to stand up and say, I'm supporting Catholic schools. Of course he was going to say that. He's a politician. For you to take that and say, this is evidence of Hitler's faith, I'm sorry, but that's ludicrous from a historical point of view and from a logical point of view.
I don't get to decide who is or isn't a true Christian, and I'm certainly not going to get into a battle of determining that because I don't see that anybody gets to decide who is or isn't a true Christian. I'm just saying, you know, and I thought earlier that we weren't going to go down this route of whether Hitler was an atheist or not. His positions... He publicly and privately represented himself as a Christian. And when somebody does that, since I don't get to say, oh, no, you're not really a Christian, I'm stuck with how they self-represent themselves. You asked me earlier to put myself in the mindset of someone in that time, in that era, which is, once again, you appealing to moral relativism as if just because it's their mindset, it's factual, and that precludes the possibility that people can be wrong about their moral opinions, which is
absolutely.
I don't think you'll find any argument from David on that, though.
Absolutely, they can be wrong about their moral opinions, but I'm finding it, you know, the combination of, I mean, maybe it is your fundamentalist background, but the naivety in what you're saying. You know, Charles Manson says, "I'm a good person and kind." Do you accept that? No, you don't. You look at the evidence. You look at the context. And so, for example, you're talking about Hitler and Gott mit uns and all that kind of rubbish that people put in. You know, I can give you numerous evidence. For example, all the German airmen who were captured over Britain during the Second World War were interviewed. Admittedly, they were interviewed by a bishop, and he went round and he asked each one of them what their faith was in, what they believed. And something like 40% of them said their faith was in Hitler, something like 10% of them said they believed in God, and the rest of them said that they were atheist. Now, that doesn't prove anything from my part. But what I find really, really fascinating in all of this, and for me, the main thing, you know, the social Darwinianism. Let me give you a quote from Hitler, from his actual secretary. He said this: "Science isn't yet clear about the origins of humanity. We are probably the highest stage of development of some mammal, which developed from reptiles and moved on to human beings, perhaps by way of the apes. We are a part of creation and children of nature, and the same laws apply to us as to all living creatures. And in nature, the law of the struggle for survival has reigned from the first. Everything incapable of life, everything weak is eliminated. Only mankind, and above all the church, have made it their aim to keep alive the weak, those unfit to live, and people of an inferior kind." Now, I would argue, when I look at the different philosophies and the different worldviews, an atheistic worldview either ends up completely illogical or complete hubris or complete madness, where the Christian worldview, for me at least, makes sense of morality and evil. Do you actually accept there's such a thing as evil?
As a thing?
No.
Good
as
and
a
evil
concept,
are,
even.
Good and evil are labels that we apply to situations, to consequences, in comparing them to particular values. Now, let me back up a second, because when you say Charles Manson says he's a good person and it's absurd to just take him at his word, that's because we have a definition and an understanding of good, and we can evaluate his actions in comparison to good. If somebody tells me they're a Christian, we don't have a good understanding of what is or isn't a Christian, or what acts a Christian could or couldn't do. And the fact of the matter is, there are plenty of people, if there's anybody who's a true Christian, maybe there are two true Christians who've never done anything wrong, but being a Christian doesn't preclude somebody from doing anything wrong, including murder. And in some cases, it actually, the beliefs in the Christian religion can encourage that. I mean, after all, we're talking about a religion that condones slavery, that is led by a God-fueled charge across the Middle East to slaughter everybody except for the chosen people, and thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. I mean, these are pronouncements that are coming directly from the Bible, and while I can't say that somebody is or isn't a true Christian, I can say whether or not there's something in the Bible that might direct them to do something that we would identify as evil, clearly evil.
Yeah, Matt. I mean, you basically you handed me a rope to hang you every time you speak because you keep saying comparison. You know, and what comparisons are we making? I mean, first of all, I mean, the question I'll come back to you. I want to make something, but the question I want to come back to you is the definition of good, because you say we know what good is. How do we know what good is? What if people have different definitions of good? And for you to say we don't have a good understanding of Christian. Yes, we do. We have a great understanding of Christian. And I mean, the rest of the wee rant about slavery and slaughtering across the Middle East, I'm really surprised for a guy who does this for a living or a guy who does it seriously. But that is a caricature of both the Old Testament and New Testament. But I absolutely know what a Christian is.
I'm glad you do, and so does everybody else who makes assertions about who is and isn't a true Christian.
Yeah, but I mean, we're back to your original philosophy that no one can actually say anything or mean anything. We're just left with this relativistic world where whatever you say is true because you've got nothing to compare it to, or whatever anyone else says. We do know what a Christian is. There are basic standards that you work by. I know that Hitler wasn't a Christian. Why? Because a Christian is someone who follows Jesus Christ. We'll do that in the next program. But let me tell you this. Jesus Christ was a Jew. Hitler would have slaughtered him as a Jew. There's no way that Hitler was a Christian. And I've read all of Hitler's private diaries that we've been able to get, even the fake ones. I've read all of Hitler's speeches. And it seems to me that what you're just doing is picking up on one or two things.
Let's move a bit away from Hitler.
Well, yeah, let's do that.
Let's talk at this point, Matt, about good. And we've been kind of not quite getting there at this point to how you define good. And obviously David has a problem with you saying it's obvious that the flourishing, the well-being of humans should not be halted. And he said, well, actually, there were people in Nazi Germany and so on who didn't see good in the same way that you see it. So what makes you right and them wrong? And I guess the point David's making here is that, well, if there is some ultimate standard of right and you really believe you are right, then it's something that actually comes from another source that is objective in that sense. So do you want to take this on?
Well, when it's, you know, an hour long talk on the superiority of secular morality. In my position, very similar to Sam Harris's, that he defines in The Moral Landscape, good, like anything else, is something that you consider in context with any particular situation. It's not like there's some definition of good that applies everywhere in every context in every situation. What I'm talking about is that there are the derivation of, and when I'm talking about morality, I'm only talking about well-being. We can chuck the word morality out of the way if it becomes troublesome and just say, okay, with respect to well-being, these actions promote well-being and these don't. And the ones that promote well-being are what we're calling good. And so, if somebody could have another definition of good and somebody could think that it's good to slaughter people, we are disagreeing with them and we are appealing. These people have divorced themselves from rational discussion.
But when the Nazis did slaughter 6 million people, they believed they were doing it for the well-being of society. So I guess what I'm asking is how can you show a Nazi that they're being irrational in that way?
Okay, let me kind of touch on this by going a half step back to slavery, which evidently David thinks is I'm representing absurdly. Mm-hmm. If you want to know what's wrong with slavery, the first thing you could do is probably talk to the slaves. And this secular view of morality that I've continually advocated is one that appeals to evidence and is your decisions about morality are the result of becoming convinced instead of converted. And so the way that you could explain to somebody that what they're doing is wrong is through reason and evidence. It's through demonstrating that this action that you're taking that you think produces this particular effect, which you consider to be good, you either convince them that what they're claiming is good is in fact not good, or that their action actually doesn't result in good. You have to address each one situationally. We're so good at it, generally speaking, that we tend to just kind of go by our gut, but that also hurts us because it gets us in a position where we don't actually take the time to think about what we're doing. And so if somebody said, hey, I think it's good to kill 6 million Jews, well, the first thing is to engage in a little Socratic method and say, why exactly do you think this is a good thing? Oh, because they're weak and they're going to destroy the planet or whatever. Well, why do you think that? Get down to brass tacks about this, because when you get down there, you're going to find out that this is not actually based on a fact. It is based on a view that has a demonstrable fallacy, in that this, or at least is counterproductive in the idea that there's some people who are weaker than others. This misunderstanding of evolution, which social Darwinism is, you know, often cited,
yeah,
kind of problematically, but it's a political theory, and then somehow it gets tied in with eugenics and other things. But it's a fundamental misunderstanding, because evolution doesn't tell you about what you should do. It doesn't. This idea of survival of the fittest, which is really actually a wrong way to look at evolution, is descriptive of what happens. It is not prescriptive about what you should do.
Well, in a sense, though, I think that's kind of David's point, is that if you do believe in just a materialist universe, you don't get a should. You just get a this is the way it is. And I suppose it's that whole question. I mean, do you want? Yeah, I don't want to speak
sure.
for you here,
yeah.
David.
Yeah, Well, I do want to ask Matt a question that I was actually asked at Cambridge University. I'd be interested to know his response to it. But can I just go back over a couple of the things that he was saying? I'm furiously scribbling notes here because it's just fascinating. I'd said initially that one of the reasons I couldn't be an atheist was because I just didn't have the faith. And Matt's faith astounds me. I'm so skeptical about what he the faith that he has. For example, well-being. Whose well-being? You know, if I'm a Wall Street banker, whose well-being am I thinking about? I'm thinking about mine and my family and stuff the poor in some other country. You know, I mean, that it's just an enormous faith to think that human beings will operate in terms of well-being of everyone else. And also this incredible faith in sitting down with people and persuading them, you know, that's a really bad idea, Charles Manson, to go out and slaughter a few people. This just doesn't work too well. Again, this approach, for me, just has an extraordinarily faith. And how do you convince people if you don't have an absolute right and wrong? But anyway, here's the question that I would want to ask. And I was, it's a question I was asked by the president of the Atheist and Agnostic Society, wonderful title, in Cambridge University. And it was in a debate. And he said, and he quoted Bertrand Russell, actually, after the Second World War on the BBC, Russell said this: Dachau, the concentration camp, Dachau is wrong, is not a fact. Geology, gravity rather, is a fact. But Dachau is wrong, is not a fact. I think it's wrong, but I can't prove it. Would you agree with that statement?
I don't know.
Well, take a stab. Where are you on that one?
Wow, okay. I didn't know that saying I don't know and actually pausing to think is thinking not allowed. I mean,
no,
first of all,
no, thinking's allowed, but okay. saying I don't know and believe, I mean it's a fairly straightforward question. It's like when you on your program you ask people questions. If they go to you, I don't know, you usually mock them.
Well, what seems to not be allowed is anything other than an actual answer. It may be the case that the answer should be we don't know or we don't know yet. This appeal that you this claim that you have that I have just enormous amounts of faith is laughable, because you actually said that I have enormous amount of faith that humans will operate on the basis of well-being. And no, I'm not saying that I have faith that they actually will.
You have faith that they can.
I have confidence that they can, because I have evidence that they can. Faith is the excuse people give for believing something when they don't have evidence. My positions are based on evidence and reason and reality. I don't have to give faith as an excuse. Now, Bertrand Russell's statement about Dachau is wrong is not a fact. I'd have to know a little bit more about the context in which he was saying that to know whether or not I agree. I think I tend to agree. In the context that I think he meant it, but I may actually disagree with what he was saying, because I am of the opinion that because there are physical truths. Now, see, the trouble word here is wrong, and that's what I'm talking about with regard to Russell's context. Dachau is in conflict with the idea of well-being of both those individuals and society is a fact. A fact that is put forth by the idea that we are physical beings under the influence of physical laws. And so what hurts us is merely a physical fact about the universe. There's nothing, as a matter of fact, appealing to anything else would be in violation of methodological naturalism.
Okay, can I come back to that? I mean, the questions and answers thing. I do think questions deserve an answer. I think it's fair enough for us to say, yeah, I'm thinking about it and I don't know, so I accept that. What I don't accept is when people take the English language and mangle it. And I don't care that you're an American. You don't have the right to do that. Faith is not faith without evidence. Yeah, the Christian position on faith, the biblical position on faith. It's Richard Dawkins and the others who've just basically invented this idea of faith, that faith is in spite of or contrary to the evidence. Faith is based upon reason and evidence. You act upon it. All of us, everything that we do is a combination of faith based on reason or faith based upon reason. And so from a Christian perspective, if you're going to argue against a Christian perspective, my faith is based on reason and evidence.
I'm going to have to just interrupt you there, David, and we will let Matt respond in the next section. We're just having to close out this section of the program, and we'll continue as we get a final sort of 10 minutes to wrap up today's debate. We're talking about why I'm not an atheist. That's the contention that David Robertson, my Christian guest on the program today, is defending. Matt Dillahunty is well known online as a leading voice in the skeptical community. He's the host of The Atheist Experience in Texas. We're going to continue this fast. Fascinating discussion between them both. It's a spirited one today on Unbelievable. Do come back in a moment's time.
Welcome back. It's time for the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, and we'll be returning to the real ding-dong between atheist Matt Dillahunty and Christian David Robertson in a moment's time. They'll be with me again next week too, so if you can come back at 2:30, do so. Also online, of course, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Next time, Matt will be explaining why he is not a Christian, and David will be responding. It's all to do with the fact David has a new book out called Magnificent Obsession, Why Jesus is Great. And of course, it ties into the second part of the Apostles' Creed, I believe in Jesus Christ, God's only Son. And that's part of the theme that we're exploring as we link these programmes to Spring Harvest's upcoming theme, which will be involved with apologetics and thinking through your faith and being confident about Christ and the Bible and so on. We're going to be hearing more about that, actually, from Malcolm Duncan, who's behind the theme for this year's Spring Harvest Conference from the 5th to the 18th of April. So hold on for that. And we'll be hearing some of the views of people I canvassed in the street on whether they believe God exists. I took some vox pops, to give it its technical term, and so we'll be hearing those as well as, of course, your feedback and so on. If you want to find out any more about today's show, and indeed Spring Harvest, who this show comes to you in association with today, do go to my website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Once the show finishes today, do stay tuned, because between 4 and 5, my guest for The Profile is Jonathan Vieira, Christian singer, songwriter, and a big personality, some great stories to boot from all over the world, plus some really interesting background to him coming out of the Brethren Church, how he dealt with that, some of his doubts, challenges, experiences in life. Do stay tuned for that between 4 and 5 if you possibly can. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So just to conclude today's discussion on why I'm not an atheist, David Robertson and Matt Dillahunty, my guests. Coming back to you, Matt, we essentially had David taking a few different points in that last section, but particularly he took issue with the idea that you say faith is believing in things without evidence, essentially. And he says, well, that's not actually what faith is. It's a kind of arbitrary definition that some atheists have come up with for it, but it is actually based on reason, and we all use faith, I suppose, in all kinds of things based on our experience and reason that undergirds it, if you like. So could you want to expand on that, or do you want to go somewhere else? I'll leave it with you.
Sure, I'll tackle this, because first of all, you know, as an American, I acknowledge that I am butcher the English language, at least from David's
No, that was a low. That was a low shot from David. Actually,
I would argue that despite David's contention, I actually do have the right to do this, both as an American with free speech and as a human being with a free mind. But this claim, the Bible flatly says, faith is the evidence, not faith is based on evidence. So I'm not portraying some, you know, absolutely absurd notion of faith. The word faith actually has many different usages in different context, or I have a faith, or I have faith that, or I have faith in. But this idea of faith based on reason is one that, while people can espouse it all day, is one I find patently absurd. If you because that puts faith in the position of I believe based on reason. Well, then just say I believe. If you say I have faith because of reason, if you have reasons, I don't see why you would insert the word faith. But I don't want to necessarily play with language. Well, because
let me give you a different word, because I was interested to hear you say earlier, Matt, when David said, well, do you have faith in people's ability to recognize the well-being of others? You said, I've got confidence in that. Now,
sure.
I don't know, is that kind of a word you would use equally for faith, David? Confidence? I don't know if that's a sort of another place marker that you could...
The verse that Matt just quoted, and again, I keep saying, you know, a text without a context is always a pretext. And the verse that he quoted is actually this. It's Hebrews 11:1. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. And then it says, by faith we understand. And it also goes on to say, by faith that we see. And the reality is that everyone, including atheists, operate by faith.
Well, it depends. I mean, if that's his definition, if he's just equating faith and confidence, then we don't have a conflict. But that's not necessarily how even most believers, or at least most believers in the United States, or those that I've interacted with or had called the show, that's not how they use faith. They're not just simply saying confidence. Of course, we can believe to varying degrees, varying levels of confidence. But, you know, looking back over the course of this, why I'm not an atheist, you know, we had the design argument, which is a classical argument that's been presented for the existence of God. And Auschwitz, which really isn't an argument for the existence of God.
Well, it's obviously the issue of whether there is a standard of evil or good in the world, where that's coming from, I suppose. So it's the moral argument, effectively, that we were debating at that point.
Yeah, it is a version of the moral argument, which is really just kind of an appeal to consequences. It's, you know, David kept referring to these ideas about moral relativism, which I happened to reject, although other atheists are moral relativists and accept it. So this idea about morality seems to be at a minimum in an unsolved state. And so, you know, my view of David's take on this morality thing is, I just don't want to live in a world that might be like this. So that is good enough reason for me to believe in God. And for me, that's simply not the case. The same is true for, you know, the appeal to good experiences in the church has nothing to do with whether or not the claims of the church are true. Now, the one thing that he did say, which we didn't address, is he believes because of the Holy Spirit. Well, that's awesome. You know, good for him. When I was a believer, I thought I believed based on the Holy Spirit. I don't think that's true now. I can't assert whether or not David actually has, you know, a revelation from the Holy Spirit or an experience of the Holy Spirit dwelling within him. I can't demonstrate that that's false, and David can't demonstrate that it's true, and it can't possibly serve as a convincing, compelling reason for anybody other than the direct experiencer to believe. As Hume pointed out, revelation's necessarily first person, and to everybody else it's hearsay. And so all of these reasons that he's given for not being an atheist don't seem to address atheism as I would define it. It seems that he's giving reasons why he's not a hard atheist or an anti-theist or the, you know, will not accept the proposition there are no gods. It doesn't address the position of disbelief.
Yes, a sort of agnostic atheism, which
an agnostic atheist. And it doesn't address the default, what I would say is the default position for a skeptic, which he has identified as, which is, I'm not going to believe this until there is sufficient evidence. And the mere idea of a direct revelation from the Holy Spirit or the various fallacies in the, you know, the classical arguments and the appeals to, I don't want to live in a world that might be like this, that shouldn't.
Okay. Well, let's allow David. I mean, we don't have long now, guys, about 5 minutes, right. If anything. And we've opened up two more areas, your issues with the church and the Holy Spirit. A brief response, David, and then we'll start to wrap it up.
Okay. I mean, for me, I actually think that Matt is right when he said earlier about you either believe or you don't. And I believe based on the evidence. And I think he has an atheistic faith based upon, I think, extremely limited evidence. He's based upon his experience and everything else as well, and his own ability, he thinks, to compare with everything. You know, I'm intrigued. I mean, one thing, I'm absolutely delighted, Matt, that you believe in moral absolutes. I just want to know where you get them, where they come from.
That's really easy. When I talk about moral absolutes and my rejection of moral relativism, I'm still talking about situational morality. And so in any given situation, there is a finite set of actions.
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
Well, actually, no, in the multiverse, they're infinite, but never mind. Carry on.
Yeah, I'm trying to stay in reality.
Okay, yeah, well, that's why I'm not an atheist. Carry on.
Carry on.
there's a finite set of possible actions, and we can compare the consequences of those actions to each other with respect to the, in this case, when I was talking about morality, the value of well-being. And so some of those actions are going to be better than others, which means that at the, that there is some set of one or more actions for a specific situation that represent a moral pinnacle. And the only thing that we need to have this absolute morality within the situation is the fact that we are physical beings in a physical universe, and that we can compare the consequences of an action with the consequences of another action, and then line them up.
Okay, well, you've just demonstrated again why I can't be an atheist, because you say you've got two things there. One is your faith. We can compare. You think we have the ability. Who is the we? And what if we disagree? If you're in Saudi Arabia comparing, or if you're in Russia right now at the Sochi Olympics or whatever and comparing, that might be different from if you're in Texas comparing. So I think that ends up just being relativistic rather than the absolute standard that you're talking about.
I just described the opposite of relativism, but
no, it's not. But it does, because when you say we can compare, who's the we? Who's the we?
Well, I was getting to that before I was interrupted. Yeah. In the sense that the determination of well-being has a number of potential conflicts: better for me, better for you, better for us. Who's doing the deciding? And those are the areas where we still have work to do. This is the process of convincing people, just like it's when you're teaching your kid why something is wrong. It doesn't do any good to say it's wrong because God said so. Your rejection of my position has nothing to do with atheism. This is my view of morality. Atheism is merely a position on the existence of God. It doesn't say anything at all about morality. There's no requirement to accept my view of morality in order to identify as an atheist. And when you list your rejection of my view of morality as a reason why you can't be an atheist, it demonstrates that you don't understand what an atheist is and why this is the default position with regard to the claim.
We'll give you one comeback, David, yeah, and then we're going to have to wrap it up.
Yeah, because I mean, I look forward to discussing it next week. What you've done is you've just demonstrated to me the self-contradictoriness of your position, because you host a program called The Atheist Experience. And if the only thing about atheism is that there is no God, you're going to have an incredibly boring show. It's going to be like one of these Norwegian TV shows watching, you know, a log fire, because it's just, there is no God, there is no God, there is no God. You're talking about morality, you're talking about experience, you're talking about everything else. And I just think your whole position is entirely self-contradictory. You started with saying, well, obviously killing 6 million people is demonstrably wrong. And I'm saying, yes, obviously it is. How is it obviously? How do we get there? I mean, the Dachau question, I was asked that question, my answer, and I'll finish with my answer, and then, you know, you get the chance to wind up, I think. I just said simply, Dachau is wrong is a fact. It depends where you start. And I start with this. You go out and you rape my 14-year-old daughter. I know that that's wrong. And then I ask, why is it wrong? Why is it wrong? Why is it wrong? Why is it wrong? And ultimately, I have to come back to an absolute morality, an absolute law, an absolute lawgiver. That's God. The atheist starts with the presupposition either that there is no God or that we can't know that there's a God. You said you couldn't say that, you weren't saying that there was possibly a God. So, and then says, well, how can we say what's right and wrong? And you come up with this, we compare this and we compare that. But logically, it just falls apart because it depends who the we is. So you had the possibility today of, you know, pushing me along your direction, because some people sometimes have done that, but I'm afraid it hasn't worked. But it's nice to talk to you
well,
anyway.
It is, and we're going to have another chance to do it next week when Matt will be, as it were, giving the case for why I'm not a Christian. Do you want to say something briefly and then we'll conclude?
Sure. I think it's ridiculous to make the argument that because our TV show talks about a lot of issues, that this is somehow makes the idea that atheism is only about the rejection of God ridiculous. Atheism is the rejection of the existence of a God. But atheists are a whole lot more, and the subjects are broad. So the fact that we talk about a lot of things on the TV show doesn't mean that all of those things are atheism, despite the name of the TV show. That was the name of the TV show. It's not remotely relevant.
All right. We'll leave it there for the moment today, gents. It has been a very feisty discussion. I knew it would be. And my guests today have been Matt Dillahunty and David Robertson. If you want to find out more about the book that David's contributed to, then do look it up online, Why I'm Not an Atheist. More details as well about David and his ministry from solus-cpc.org.
atheistcenter.org. That's the Solar Center for Public Christianity. And if you want more about Matt, atheist-community.org, and links there to the atheist experience and various other things. Okay, we're going to continue this next week. So we're going to continue a feisty discussion next time here on the programme. So I won't say goodbye. I'll simply say au revoir. And if you would like to contribute your thoughts on today's show, then why not get in touch? Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can find links to the Facebook and Twitter accounts as well from the web page, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I look forward to engaging on all those mediums as we get some of your feedback to this programme. We're going to hear some of your feedback to last week's as well in a moment's time. So do stick around here on Unbelievable, and do come back again next week for more from David and Matt.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I've been mentioning the link that today's programme has to Spring Harvest, and indeed the next two. Spring Harvest is a major Christian festival that takes place around Easter time here in the UK each year over two sites at Minehead and Skegness. I'll be involved in helping to deliver some seminars on the big questions around faith and how we can be confident in our faith. Well, I've been out on the streets of London asking other people what they believe. And one of the questions I asked was, do you believe in God?
I used to. I was raised as a Hindu. And as I grew older, just started to think about it more.
I have more of a spiritual belief, as in not a religious belief.
Just because there's no sort of evidence that there is a God, and I was brought up not believing in God.
I believe there must be a higher power, someone in charge. I don't think it's just randomly happened that we exist.
I stopped believing in God when I discovered that Father Christmas was a fabrication, and I thought, what else have they been lying to me about?
Well, I wonder how you would respond to that question of, do you believe God exists? You may believe it, but would you be able to give a reason for the hope that's in you, as 1 Peter 3:15 puts it? Well, that's certainly what the aim of Spring Harvest this year is about. It's about helping us be confident in our faith. Some fantastic seminars, engagements, speaking events and so on, all going on within the context of the 5th to the 18th of April when Spring Harvest happens. I'm going to be there along with my colleague Tom Price of the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, delivering some seminars on Is Christianity Unbelievable? Asking those questions and giving some advice on Is God a delusion? Don't dead people stay dead? What about suffering? Alongside all that, all loads of worship, Hillsong London, Tim Hughes, Kathy Burton, Pete James and more. Bible teachers as well, including Paula Gooder, Simon Ponsonby, Steve Brady and Malcolm Duncan, who is heading up the theme for this year as well. Malcolm, welcome along to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks very much, Justin. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you on. We happen to share a name, a title in common for this year's Spring Harvest, Unbelievable. Tell me why you chose that as the theme and what you're hoping to achieve.
Well, I guess the reason for choosing the theme and the title Unbelievable is actually about good apologetics and being able to defend the confidence that we can have in God and to rediscover it in some ways and to rediscover the confidence that God has in us. And your show aims to help people think through some of the big questions of the day, some of the big challenges of society. And Spring Harvest this year is about asking this fundamental question. Can we have confidence in God still? Can we have confidence in the Bible? Does he have confidence in us? Is the church relevant or irrelevant? All of that stuff.
And it's not just for apologetics nuts like me, of course, is it? You're aiming to kind of apply this to a wide variety of ways in which people engage their faith and their ordinary life.
The whole thing is for all Christians. I mean, the reality is, an old sage said to me many years ago, you're always a witness, Malcolm, when you become a Christian. You're either a good one or a bad one. And you're always doing theology. You're either doing it well or doing it badly. You know, a mom or a dad seeking to bring up their kids, taking them to school, or a professor in a theology college trying to teach people how to understand and relate to the Bible as God's inspired and infallible word. I face the same challenges. Do they believe it? And if they believe it, how do they articulate that? And Spring Harvest is trying to do that from tiny tots and kids, helping them with confidence in God and God's confidence in us, all the way through to people who will be really inspired by some of the lectures and some of the seminars that you will be taking in, Tom, and others, around how to address specific questions. I think it's probably one of the most important spring harvests we've had, and I trust God will really use it to give confidence back to his church.
Well, we're in the midst of a few programmes where we're taking some of the big themes from the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God the Father, I believe in Jesus Christ, I believe in the Holy Spirit. And that's the sort of theme you're taking as well for the Bible readings, for the teaching, and for the spaces that, as it were, develop that theme afterwards.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the interesting thing is there are 36,000 denominations, Trinitarian Christian denominations in the world. Can you believe that? That's incredible to me. 36,000. Of those, they fall into five main streams. There are Catholics, there are Orthodox, there are Anglicans, there are Protestants, and there are other denominations. But those five streams, those 36,000 denominations, are held together by the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God the Father, I believe in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, and I believe in the Holy Spirit. Those statements really unite us, they solidify us. And you can have lots of people coming along, you know, saying things like, well, I believe the gospel is this, or I believe the gospel is that, or I believe Jesus is this or that, or whatever. The challenge and the power of the Apostles' Creed is, it's united Christians for almost 2,000 years. Appeared in print around 390 for the first time, was referred to in 252. This almost 2,000-year-old document holds us together. It keeps us accountable. Do you know what I mean by that? It holds us accountable to the faith once delivered. It reminds us that we're not free to change the gospel. We're not free to change the Bible. And in the spaces, we'll be helping people think about, what does it mean to believe in God the Father as a Father? Or what does it mean to believe in God the Father with regard to creation or the environment or in apologetics or in work? And in the Bible studies, we'll be unpacking what it means to believe in God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit. And then in the evening celebrations, we'll be encouraging people not just to talk about this, but to encounter God as Father, to encounter the forgiveness of the Son, and to encounter and be filled with the power of the Spirit.
It sounds wonderful. I'm a big fan of Spring Harvest. I've been going there in a, you know, personal capacity with my family for years, and have appreciated the ministry it's had. I'm so pleased to be able to be involved helping with delivering some material this year as well. So, Malcolm, thank you for talking to us about it. If people want to find out more, then easiest thing, I suppose, is springharvest.org to find out what's available, how they can book in.
Yeah, that's it. And there are lots of special things that they can do. We're encouraging leaders. If you're a church pastor and you've never been to Spring Harvest, we'd love to give you a free day so you can come and take a look and think about bringing a group next year. We're introducing for some of the weeks 2-day breaks and 3-day breaks so that people can come and have a taster of it. Mm. It promises to be a great event, and it'll be made strong by contributions from you and other people who love God, love his word, and want to stand up for him in our society.
Well, thank you for being on the programme with me today, Malcolm.
God bless you.
Just a chance to sneak in some of your emails to the last few weeks of programming, and we'll leave more space for more of them next week, because I'm sure lots of people will want to respond to today's show. My name is R.D. McLennigan, says one. He's teaching pastor at the Door Creek Church in Madison, Wisconsin, a city similar to Oxford or Cambridge in size and culture. Your podcasts have been super helpful to me, engaging with college students and secular professionals who make up our city. I listen all the time and always enjoy the calibre of your guests and the kindness with which you host the show and engage them during the entire program. Thank you very much, RD. Lovely to receive emails like that. Here's Dan, who says, wanted to thank you for Unbelievable. Great show. There aren't many programs that balance the views of both belief and non-belief so well. A question for you. Would you say the primary idea of the show to spread the Christian message or to find the truth, whatever that might be? You might say both, but I wondered hypothetically, if you found that the program was deconverting more people than converting, would you continue with it? Well, that's an interesting question. It is obviously a hypothetical one, but I'd have to say that in good conscience, I would have to continue, because I do think the important thing is to search for the truth. I believe the truth of Christianity can be defended. It is perfectly rational to be a Christian. Obviously, what people take away from the programme, I can't be exactly responsible for. I can only be responsible for the content within it to a degree. Thank you for emailing, Dan. And you said you'd love to hear a show with Matt Dillahunty and David Robertson, possibly discussing morality. Well, you got your wish come true today, didn't you, Dan? Glad that you were able to email in. Now, we've had some responses to last week's programme. Ryan Bell is the former pastor who's trying on atheism for a year, and he was in conversation about that with Matt Flanagan, a Christian apologist from New Zealand. Here's Ryan, who says, you just finished listening, and you were surprised by some of the things Ryan Bell said. His talk about morality and saying that there is, in a sense, a moral foundation, but I tend to be sceptical of foundations. My thinking tends to be more along more non-foundational lines. And you wanted to say about that, well, while I myself hold no degrees in philosophy, I do my best to read and stay on top of the most recent materials, and it breaks my heart that someone like Ryan, who spent years studying and teaching at institutions like Fuller and Azusa, could be so woefully ignorant of the vast wealth of research and scholarship revolving around the question of God's existence and character. I'm currently working with some folks at Campus Crusade for Christ to develop an app for apologetics, and hearing Ryan's thoughts only strengthens my conviction and resolve to provide answers to Christians about those questions. I think programmes like yours are a marvellous step in the right direction. Thank you very much indeed. There was also the conclusion of the faith swap. That was Simon Capes and Bentley Browning, a Christian and atheist who swapped lives for a month to see what it would like to try and live as an atheist or a Christian. Jay wanted to get in touch, said really enjoyed the airing. Concerning Bentley, I found it very interesting that he said his life wasn't really affected that much by living as an atheist for a month. Really? I find that hard to believe if you're a Christian anyway. Obviously, you're not going to see long-term effects in 1 month, but I think you'd have more than just an occasional headache from not praying. On the other hand, I'm completely fine with and would even encourage a person to try living the Christian experience, so to speak, for a while. Not because that would save them, but I believe there is a level of blessing they'd experience from being among the body of Christ. That could very well be what God uses to save them. So I guess I'm really okay with both scenarios after all, because God may well be saving both of them through their experiences or similar experiences in other people. And Jonathan in Santa Marta, Colombia said, I wanted to comment on that discussion between Simon and Bentley. I think it reveals so much about modern Christianity. For example, I was surprised Simon said no one tried to persuade him to become a Christian and that Bentley's Christian friends were cool with his desire to try on atheism for a month. In Simon's experience, it appears no one shared with him the truth claims of Christ revealed in Scripture. The churches he attended seemed to centre more on personal experience than on the Word of God. For example, the prayer, God, if you're there, reveal yourself to me, makes no sense apart from a biblical understanding of God, sin, and the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thanks for all those who've been in touch. And sorry, I haven't had as much time as normal to read out some of your responses today on the programme. Do come back again at the same time next week. We're going to be having another interesting debate between my guests who join me today. Let me tell you what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
Why I'm Not a Christian. That's what we're going to be debating as Matt Dillahunty this time takes the lead and David Robertson responds. It'll be another one you won't want to miss. So come back again, same time next week. In the meantime, thank you for joining me on today's show. And do stick around for the profile interview coming up in a moment's time. My guest, Jonathan Vieira.